Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Carter. This week's episode comes from last Thursday's home-centered Sunstone live stream, which was titled, What Would a Prophetic People Do During a Pandemic? I forgot to push the record button until my introduction was over, so I'm recording it for you here. You're welcome. As you may have noticed, we live in interesting times. It's not just the pandemic, which is interesting enough. It's the astonishing political divide that seems to have grown exponentially in the United States since the advent of the internet. We seem to live in a new Babel where we speak mutually exclusive ideological languages that make us unable to communicate even about a pandemic that affects the entire world. As I've been watching all of this march by on various news outlets and on my Facebook feed, a scripture came to mind, actually. Joshua has just come up to Moses to tell him that he should stop two men from prophesying. And Moses said, Are you jealous for my sake? I wish that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his spirit on them. That's Numbers 11:29, in case you're flipping frantically through your scriptures like most of our listeners do. So the scripture fired up two thoughts. One was, on social media, everyone acts like a prophet, and it's chaos. And the other was, wait, what if we were actually prophets? Would it be chaos then? And then I took it one step further. Latter-day Saints believe in continuing revelation. We also believe in personal revelation. Doesn't that give us some unique tools that could help us learn to be this prophetic people Moses was wishing for? The world could certainly benefit from it. So, to explore this question, we brought together a panel of people with diverse backgrounds. See, we weren't so interested in people who could tell us about the history of prophets as we were in people who could help us imagine, from a number of different angles, what being prophetic might look like. So, we have with us Misha McGriggs, Daniel Carter, and Lindsay Hansen Park. And now, each of them will be briefly introducing themselves in that order.
So, I'm Misha McGriggs. I live in New York City. I'm a psychologist by training. Did my PhD at BYU, and I'm always interested in, you know, the intersections of race and religion, and particularly with Mormonism and how those play out. So I would say that I'm a pretty progressive Mormon, and you know, I love to really think about religious history and theology, probably much more than I actually enjoy being in the pews every week. But thanks for having me, and I'm excited to think about how we can maybe deconstruct and liberate the term prophet a little bit.
I like those two terms. All right, Dan, take it away.
All right. Hi, I am Daniel Carter. As you will notice, I have a similar last name to the host, for we are brothers. I am the brother of Stephen. So a little bit of my background. I live out in Washington, D.C. I've lived here for several years and really enjoyed it. It's an amazing place. I currently work in IT with the Food and Drug Administration, but my undergrad was in social work and dance, and my master's degree was in peace operations, which was the study of conflict resolution through the eyes of the United Nations and U.S. policy, and looking at the way that especially post-war countries deal with things and how terribly we go about reconstructing them and pulling them back together. I am also a deep lover of theology and spiritual ponderings, and have dived deep into Buddhism a lot within my own experiences and studies, and also recently actually left the Mormon Church back in June. So I'm in a transitionary state, and it's been fascinating to experience it on both sides, what the community is like. So, yeah.
Daniel also has the distinction of being one of the people that Jana Reese interviewed for her book.
Yes, I am the first chapter. That is true.
Just in case that gives you guys some context. All right, Lindsay, take it away.
I think we need to have all 8 Carter kids on one time. Just have you guys do one of those YouTube, or what's everyone doing on Facebook Live, all the videos you can all take apart. It'll be great.
It's a good idea. We'll do it.
I'm Lindsay at the Park. I am the executive director of Sunstone, and I do a lot of work with diverse Mormons all over the Mormon spectrum. And so when we talk about prophets, I know it specifically and most frequently in a Mormon context. But when I say Mormon, I mean all the different traditions across the restoration. So we're talking anywhere from the people who stayed in Nauvoo or even in Kirtland and how they interpreted Mormon doctrine to all the people that came over with Brigham Young and have split off into, you know, almost 500 groups of Mormons today. So I know a lot of prophets, I guess, is my weird brag.
Lindsay knows the prophets. That's awesome. I'm really grateful to have all of you here. And now I'm going to change this to gallery view because I want all of our people to be able to see all of your faces as we talk about prophets. So I chewed this topic over with a few people during the past few days so that I could prepare for tonight's episode. And one thing that became really clear right off the bat was that we need to get a few definitions for what we even mean when we say prophetic, especially since we're going to be applying it to normal people like us. So let's spitball, all of us here together for a few minutes, and see what our ideas about being a prophet, what are our ideas about being prophetic? Is anybody here excited to jump onto that, or should I ask a leading question?
Well, I can start with something. I just want to talk about the way that I grew up in a traditional LDS ward in you know, the Wasatch, on the Wasatch Front. And so for me, prophet immediately still, even though all the experiences and training that I've had to the contrary of this signals obedience to me, right? I still can't decouple prophet from obedience, because in my tradition, it was sort of this hierarchical top-down. We listen to the prophet speaks, we listen, we follow the counsel, we do what the prophet says. So that's sort of my initial knee-jerk reaction to the term.
That feels familiar. What about the rest of you? What comes to mind when we say prophet?
My initial reactions to thinking about prophet and prophetic was similar to Lindsay's, but I've been thinking more and more on it as I've talked with various friends and family members to try to figure it out. And it, for me, prophetic came to a point of someone who is able to understand the situations and people around them to the point where they can see so many steps ahead that they can react and help or give guidance in a way that most people could not. And that if we take it away from the spiritual answer of God giving revelation to someone to lead others, I would think that would be a very a good way of putting prophet or prophetic within more secular / spiritual terms.
I really like that, Daniel. And I think just to kind of maybe build on that a little bit, I guess I prefer verbs over nouns generally, because I think that nouns are, they feel really they're deterministic in some way. And I think that whenever you can continue to be in process, your verbs just give a little more, you know, they're action words. So I really like to think of like acts of that are prophetic or prophesying. And yeah, I really like the idea of someone who has vision, right? Is connected, is anticipatory. When you're in that moment, that is connected to self in a way, or to something bigger than yourself, even, or to others around you, and you're able to anticipate their needs, or anticipate your own needs, and then you have a plan, and you're prepared to kind of meet the challenge or meet whatever is needed in that moment. And so, I really think of that as prophetic.
It sounds to me like you guys are talking about people with high emotional intelligence. Is that basically what you're getting at?
No, not so much, because high emotional intelligence is definitely part of it when you're talking about people, but people are not the only things that make up situations and issues. I mean, if we even just take the pandemic, for example, then there are definitely other components outside of people that are moving. And so understanding the political constraints of something, or understanding the just personal needs, whether that be food or shelter or the quarantining, or those different elements all stack into understanding the full situation, which I think is much more logistic and pattern oriented rather than just the emotional intelligence, which has elements of those but isn't necessarily comprehensive.
That's interesting. Does this bring up any thoughts in you, Lindsay?
No, I don't necessarily think that in the theological sense, at least in the Christian understanding of prophets, that emotional intelligence was the, like, you know, that was the characteristic that someone had to have be a prophet. And yet, in my exploration of all these different traditions, it's interesting. You know, I joke that I know a lot of prophets, and I do, and I wouldn't characterize them as emotionally intelligent. I wouldn't necessarily. Okay. I gotta be careful. Some are great. But in the LDS context, people are obsessed with the idea of being scripturally literate. That is such a huge traditional role in the LDS tradition that signals that someone really knows their stuff. And so a lot of those guys focus on that.
So they're very connected to the discourse of the community. They know the discourse of their community very well. And so they're more connected with the people's narrative and how to move that narrative forward, or how to keep them close to the original narrative. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
I think we have in Mormonism coupled prophet with leader. So it's become almost inseparable from some sort of authority. Especially in Mormonism, we're obsessed with authority. And so a prophet has to have authority. So whenever, you know, we're talking in these spheres of these different religious traditions of Mormon authority, who has the right authority, which prophet has the correct authority, that becomes an issue. And so when we sort of marry the two, priesthood and prophetic leadership in Mormonism, largely that leaves out women, you know, unless we're talking about the Community of Christ tradition or something like that. So that already eliminates, you know, a complete gender of people. And then, you know, we have, especially in Mormon fundamentalism, there are races of people that are prohibited from leadership. So I think the tension that I see in Mormonism has to do with patriarchal authority and what that looks like in prophetic leadership. So we talk about, like, these ideas of what a prophet should be able to see the future, and they should be able to lead and liberate. But I don't think that that's necessarily how Mormons see the prophetic role.
I think you're very right about that. And it's also interesting that you use prophetic role as if it's something that someone is. And on the other side, over here with Misha and Daniel, they've been talking about being prophetic as if it's something you do, rather than something that is like a part of your identity. Am I getting you guys right on that?
Yeah, I think that definitely the things that Lindsay was saying is true, especially if we're looking at it from the Mormon context. Mm-hmm. Definitely prophet is a role or mantle or identity portion to someone. But I think that there's a lot more power in it when we speak about it, like Misha was saying, within the verb context of being a prophetic person. And thus it's not something that someone gave to you. It's something that is developed and a skill that is used in that regard.
Yeah, I think, you know, I always love to, you know, move this conversation outside of the esoteric or the mystical, but I think to bring it back to, you know, just from the Mormon perspective, there were moments, even if you were to see a prophet as a mantle or a role or an identity of a person or persons, right? There were moments when prophets from, you know, Mormon history have said, I'm not speaking as a prophet right now. I'm speaking as a man, right? And so in that, to me, that says that it isn't intrinsic to identity or to a person, but that it is certainly something that you can step into or be moved out of or step out of, even if you are talking from a more traditional kind of like Mormon framework or theological framework.
Okay, that's really interesting. So would we be willing to say, let's have some fun then. We say that there are prophets, we say that there is prophecy, but what would we consider to be an actual act of prophetic imagination? What is a prophetic act? Like, let's point at something and say, something like that would be a prophetic act.
I think right now, in this pandemic moment that we're having, I think that any time that Dr. Fauci steps up and counters whatever President Trump is saying about his area of expertise, he is acting prophetically. He is taking on leadership. He understands he has the skill set to forecast, to predict, not in a way that is spiritual, but in a way that is rooted in his field and in his scientific studies for many years, many decades. And he takes that experience and he leads with his words. And so I think it could be really radical and maybe really offensive to call Dr. Fauci a prophet to some people. But there have been moments when I've sat and watching the news and, you know, he says something that just shuts down what the president has said. I'm like, thank God he got up, right? And said that, because we needed something that made sense in that moment. And that feels powerful and prophetic to me.
And so you're connecting prophecy, a prophetic act, with being rooted in something you know deeply, and also being willing to own that knowledge and stand up to power with it?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, because I don't see it as a role or identity, I wouldn't say that he's been a prophet forever right now, but like in this moment, there have been acts that have felt really prophetic to me.
Interesting.
You step up to the ultimate authority and say, actually, I know something that's more realistic or higher than whatever you're saying, even though you've been deemed as the authority. And I think that's powerful and comforting.
That reminds me of, I appreciate that framing, Misha, because when I first started interacting with Community of Christ as a faithful, active Latter-day Saint, their theology and their interpretation of Mormon scripture was pretty strange to me. It was almost unfamiliar in some ways, because they took words like this and I would say reconstructed it to have more practical applications. And so one of the first times that happened to me is I had lost my great-grandmother. She had died and we were going to her funeral, and I had asked Robin Linkhart, who's now an apostle of Community of Christ. She's a woman apostle ordained with the priesthood, grew up on the same scripture as I did. And I said, so what does heaven look like to you? Like, how does this work with Community of Christ? Because when we die in LDS tradition, this is what our heaven looks like. But did you guys abandon that too? Did you reconstruct that too? And she said, you know, for a long time, our church spent a lot of time focusing on what the next world would look like. And now we're focusing on what it looks like now. And so instead of building this future Zion in the future, we're building moments of Zion now. And that was the first time I'd ever heard someone take my language and sort of reappropriate it in a way that made sense. And they've been doing the same thing with prophetic people, which Stephen is going to talk about later. But they, I think, were the first ones that gave me permission to go, oh, prophet doesn't have to mean what I think it means. You know, you have to understand that the majority of us, our theological training comes from our church Sunday school, right? So what I know about the Bible, what I know about the scriptures, what I know about prophets, I learned in an LDS Sunday school. That's the majority of my training on prophets. And so it's really hard for me to shake anything other than we have a prophet for our time. He's going to predict the end of the world. And that's his role. He's going to keep us safe spiritually. So when you're talking about these new characters, you know, doctors, there are some incredible scientists out there who have been called climate prophets, right? Trying to talk about climate change. And And in all the ways of the Bible, they fit, you know, sort of this person, this lone person standing on the wall crying danger, and people aren't listening. And yet we have a hard time really going into the secular world for prophetic voices. We listen, we stay in the religious realm, and I think that that is really limiting. And I think it just, at least from my own experience, the leadership that I've gotten from prophetic leadership is pretty static.
Harriet Tubman was known as the modern Moses, right? So, I think that, even just looking back at historical figures, like people who seek to liberate, who seek to lead, who are, or maybe not seek it, but are found in a place where the timing and their skill set and their knowledge is, it all meets the moment, and they step into that moment with real leadership. And so, I think what we've seen it in scripture, certainly, aided sometimes by hallucinogenic substances. Thank you. We got some good stuff in the Bible, but also throughout secular history, and then even today, right? And I think being able to kind of thread those together to find those characteristics, but also those moments where we can step into our own prophetic selves, I think is really, could be powerful for each of us.
Do you have anything to say on that, Dan? Oh, that quiet one.
I have a very different example.
Okay, yeah, go.
So one example from my experience, two-ish years ago, then I went on a 10-day meditation retreat. And the fascinating thing about this whole experience was that, one, it was free, and it was, you could only donate to the meditation retreats after you had gained something from it. And so only if you had completed the 10-day meditation retreat could you actually donate your time or your money to it. And it was this fascinating setup, and it was by a guy named S.N. Goenka. And he lived in India. He learned Vipassana meditation, the traditional Buddhist meditation styles, and said, you know what? I think that this needs to be given to everyone. Like that's what Buddha was going for, was to bring this universal practice and these universal tools and allow all to partake of it. And so he came to the States and began creating these camps. And everyone was saying, you will not survive if you don't charge money. You need funds to make this work. And he said, I strongly believe that we need to go off of the principles of living off the charity of others, that there may be community and support, and so that all can partake, so that it is not limited to those who have means. And he stuck to it, and it is now spread. And there are Vipassana meditation retreats all over the US and in all other parts of the world that stem from S.N. Goenka. And this, to me, is a prophetic action where he first received all of this teaching. He saw the need much further than everyone else was seeing, and was then able to step into that with confidence and thus give it to others. He was able to see further because he understood the situation and the needs and had the knowledge to give. So that's one of my biggest examples, I think, of a prophetic act of a person.
That's really interesting. Two of the main words that I've heard come up so far in this is liberation and also, I just lost the word, giving freely. Misha was talking about how Harriet Tubman was a liberator. And then Daniel was talking about how this guy put together this new model. And I have to ask, Dan, did you donate?
Of course we donate.
Good job. All right. You brought his prophecy to pass. Good job. But this is interesting.
I benefited greatly from it.
But this is interesting to me because I'm kind of with Lindsay in that most of my life, to me, what a prophet was a focusing force. This was a person who said, this is what you need to do. This is the burden that you must carry. This is the way that you must go. And but what you guys have been talking about so far are people who actually kind of open things up so that there's more potential, more things that could be happening because they make room for them. Does that sound like a prophet that is more interesting to you guys, or would you prefer the more focused prophet who sends us all in a particular direction?
I've tried to really reflect on in the last few years in interacting with prophets. It has been such an interesting experience to believe in a one true prophet and then meet a lot of people who have their one true prophet, but it's a different guy, you know, and it's the same sort of advice that they're giving, the same sort of instruction. And that's really had to make me rethink how I look at prophets. In the scriptures, the way that I was taught, it was someone, you know, standing on a watchtower warning us. And, you know, Daniel talked about this longer view, and I like that. But I guess that the question would be, who is benefiting? Because we have prophets all over, in the sense that there are many voices talking about many different things. And so is a prophet someone who just predicts the future? Because I don't know how useful that is, right? You know, predicting an event is not so useful as maybe preparing someone for an event or taking, like you said, the longer view. For me, what I find interesting in prophetic action is someone who is looking with a wider view to how, you know, certain actions or behaviors or events are going to impact large amounts of people and how they work with that. We're talking about the COVID response right now. I think it would be a beautiful time for LDS people to reflect on how to use the good from their tradition in a way that has a larger impact. That is, the world doesn't need missionary work right now. I think that that's not what our focus needs to be. And so why not use our prophetic callings and our authority and our priesthood to direct it into something that truly does impact the lives of a global community for the better? How I've seen it done is we're building temples all over. So LDS people would say that that is making the world a better place. But I'm thinking less tangible and more ideas. I mean, I think a prophet should turn the hearts of the people, give them new ideas, radical compassion, radical acceptance, radical self-acceptance. To me, those would be useful things from a prophetic voice.
And that's a pretty interesting thing to say, but I can see Misha saying something. Say it, Misha.
No, you can go ahead, Stephen.
Still okay? Okay. dang, I just lost it. What you're bringing up is really interesting, because you're right. A lot of what the Salt Lake Brighamites think when they think of prophet is that there's this one guy who's going to focus all of our efforts. And it seems to me, Lindsay, that you're opening it up. You're saying prophetic acts should be something that everybody does. Everybody should be opening up these liberating concepts, liberating people, opening up more possibilities to people, especially now. What is it that we have that we could actually offer? Like, is there something unique that we can give out?
I would say that people
got a lot of money.
Very good.
You're not wrong.
People are already doing that, though. We're talking about in this future, if people could claim the prophetic role. First of all, they do. And I'm not kidding. I see this in my work. New prophets every day. Some of the people listening out there, Ben Schaefer, I know you're listening. You can back me up on this. There are a lot of prophets. There's this tension in our community with personal revelation and priesthood authority. And what I have found, and this is kind of why we've sort of shifted our goal at Sunstone to More Than One Way to Mormon, because the idea is More Than One Way to Mormon is true. That's the truth. Because there are so many different ways to do this. And we've seen it. And we have evidence now that there's so many different ways to do this. I say the same thing with prophetic leadership. Who is the better authority on your life than you? You know, you've lived it, you've experienced it. So why not claim some of that for yourself? If the gospel is for all, it should be for all. And like I said on the last podcast we did, I'm getting disinterested in religion that becomes obsessed with telling you that this is salvation and we will, you know, sort of ration it out for you when we deem you worthy. Here's salvation. If you do these things, then we'll give you, you know, a little worthiness card. To me, that's not radical. To me, that's business, you know? And I feel like prophetic leadership should be like Daniel talked about, giving that to all people.
And one of the things that I've noticed is that there have been people who have been prophetic for me personally. They haven't been prophets for the world, but they've been prophetic for me personally and have opened up sort of my inner light so that I could go according to my light. They didn't thrust their light upon me. They didn't say, here's the thing that you should believe in order to have a good life or to be fulfilled. They were able to open me up. And I don't know, have any of you others had a similar experience? Someone who acted prophetically in your life, not as like a world leader or anything? I'm trying to look smaller here into the microcosm.
So not quite on that, actually more of the opposite side of it, where I saw people reaching for it and being stopped. Where, so this is coming to much experience in the Mormon church, that I was in a YSA branch in here in Maryland, and it was right after the transition had happened from home teaching and visiting teaching going to ministering. And this shift, I mean, we could argue all over about if it's just a face change or not, but for the YSA elders quorum that was in this branch I was in, it was exciting. It was energizing. And they were like, we are going to revelation the crap out of this and come to understand what we can do to bring this community this strength, this power that we feel is available here. And they just went nuts with it. And it was amazing. And so then we're sitting there in elders quorum, and they get up and they spend like 40 minutes detailing how this is all going to work and how ministering is going to work. And it was beautiful because it was them sincerely seeking for revelation, for prophecy, for themselves to then distribute. I mean, it was an act of that prophecy. And then the branch president stood up and shut it down because it was not how he envisioned it should be. And he didn't think that it should be so much, and it should be smaller, and it should be super similar to how home teaching and visiting teaching went. And it made me so mad that when I had my exit interview with him from that branch, I gave him a very strong piece of my mind that was not okay, because here were these men who grabbed that calling that they felt for themselves and were running with it, only to have a leader come along and say, no, you're not supposed to shine. And that was not okay.
That's rough. And to me, all prophecy has to be rooted in a spirit of abundance, right? So it seeks to multiply, it seeks to improve, it seeks to grow, and it is not constrained by fear. It's not constrained by capitalism. It is not limited to whatever we can kind of put our finger on right now. Like it to me, it has to be abundant. It can't be based in scarcity politics. And so when I hear something like Daniel's story with this branch president, it's like, that's someone who is ruled by fear and scarcity, right? And ego probably. And like, that's the antithesis to being prophetic.
We have historical examples within our own tradition, right? We have one of the things that I think is really compelling to me about the Mormon tradition and Joseph Smith's restoration was that you can see when he was starting the church, he was experimenting with theology and leadership. And there was a time when everybody was a seer, right? There were competing seers, and people had seer stones, and people were doing these things. And even into the frontier period, we have these traveling prophets, these apostles that would go preach. They weren't constrained by new YSA rules or correlation or anything that we have now. Joseph Smith had sort of that vision, but also we see examples where, like with Sally Chase, Joseph Smith didn't like competing revelation with his own. And Misha, I'm so glad that you pointed out scarcity, because I think scarcity is one of the most cancerous things that can happen in theology. And, you know, it's liberation theology. It's Fatima Soleil that taught me about abundance theory and this idea that there's always more. And I've tried to incorporate that practice into my life. And Stephen, you talk about prophets. I honestly think the prophets in my own life in the Mormon tradition have been from the fringes of our tradition. So, you know, Mormons of African descent who have not traditionally been given leadership roles within our church, those are the ones that taught me about liberation theology and about abundance. And I'm telling you, I was able to incorporate abundance into my life. And when I can do that, when I can stay grounded in abundance, that there is enough for everyone, that there's enough love, that there are enough resources, that there's enough of God's love and salvation, I do better in life, mentally, spiritually, physically. It's just a good way to live my life. And so I think that we have prophetic tradition within our communities, but we often look at the wrong side of things. And maybe Daniel, you know this with your peace studies, but we're always looking for the top to tell us what to do. We're not looking to the margins of for our theology, right? We're not looking to our queer and trans brothers and siblings, brothers, sisters, and siblings to give us theology. And that's who we should be looking to, because they're in the trenches. They know what it's like to deal at the blunt end of scarcity. And we should be paying attention to that.
So this actually makes me think of an experience that Stephen and I actually had when he came out and visited me in DC. We went to the Masonic Temple and had a great time there, but we talked with this man at the end, and he brought up the symbol of the beehive, which is interestingly enough right behind Lindsay. But we had the beehive that we talked about, and he talked about how they view it, which was so different from Mormons, which is Mormons, it's industry. It's that we go and we're worker bees and we do things. But for them, it was the bees go out, they collect, and they bring back. So within the Masonic tradition, the people went out, they learned, and they brought back to enrich the hive, that it may do better, that it may reach out more, that it may serve, support, and understand the world around it. And that's where, if we're talking about prophetic people, a prophetic community, which I think that Mormon words and stuff could be, except there's so much reliance upon a head. There's so much reliance upon a leader, rather than the grassroots being able to live, breathe, and say, I think that we could do this, or I think we could do this. I think that we could, how about we all bring together our food storage and find the people that are quarantined and that can't take care of themselves and are having a hard time getting their food, and let's make a system so we can take care of them. Yeah, let's do that. And then the bishop says, no, we're supposed to keep that within our own community. But that's not the case. So that's where when I think of not just prophetic person, but a prophetic people, it's a people that actively, they seek to better understand others and their situations so that they can better serve and include them. If that be the LGBTQ community, if that be people who are of a different race than a majority of the people in the religion or the community, or if it be people that practice different religious things or are of a different economic class or all sorts of things, that as that understanding grows, the ability to prophetically act to help and serve others grows within the community, and a greater understanding and inclusiveness is available. And that's something that is very difficult for a lot of groups, including post-war countries, if we're talking about the rebuilding, because either people want to go straight to the head, or people just want grassroots, and they have a hard time allowing there to be a synergy where The grassroots is listened to, it's built, and then it works all together in one cohesive unit to then go out and serve and work together. Because there does need to be some form of leadership, but it doesn't have to be a dominant form.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've noticed about General Conference is that everybody, most of the people come because there's going to be some great new announcement. And it's dramatic, but then you think, well, the reason it's dramatic is because nobody feels like they were a part of putting together this policy. And so there's all that top down, and you never see the grassroots working. And so we always think that everything is from God. We don't think that God could work through us to send something up to be a part of that. But what you guys are talking about is really interesting. The abundance theory and also theology from the margins. It actually reminds me of when I was a newly returned missionary, newly married, and I was all the stereotypes, every single one, just to let you know. So the only thing that I wasn't very good at as far as Mormon stereotypes go is preparing to make a living. For some reason, I was getting a degree in English. And my second course was in women's lit. And in a week or two of the course, one of my classmates, he was this very handsome, confident, outspoken fellow with a philosophy course or two under his belt. And I'm not talking about me as much as it may sound like me. And he started talking about how disappointed he was in what we'd been reading in this women's lit class. He was like, there's no optimism here. The philosophers, you know, the classical philosophers were inquisitive. They explored new ideas. They found joy in life. But these writers, they're just depressed and pessimistic. They make the world look so dark. And all they write about is themselves. I'm getting tired of reading them. They're just nothing worth engaging with. So the next time we met, the professor got up, and she kind of thought for a minute while she's looking at us. And then she sort of gathered herself together and said, so after our last class, I went home and I cried for a few hours. At first, I was really angry because of what this guy over here said. I felt attacked. I felt dismissed. But then I started thinking about it some more, and I started to realize that he was right. When you read women's literature, you're usually reading about suffering. What it's like to be treated as second class. And that brings up a lot of anger. You don't have room to be joyful or curious or optimistic because you're trying to survive. You're trying to see if, you know, there's anything of your own that exists under all the self-loathing you've been taught to feel your entire life. So women's literature is often about clawing your way towards some semblance of a soul with the whole world working against you. So I resonate with these women. They're telling my story. They're telling the story of so many women. You're right. They're speaking from suffering, and we should listen to them. And it's a moment that I remember, not because it was such a great speech, but because the professor would have been thoroughly within her rights to just take that guy down. I mean, who did he think he was coming in here with his little undergrad philosophy classes and turning his nose up at a literary tradition he knew nothing about, especially when there was a PhD in the room who could have helped him to understand these writers? But instead, what really occurred to me was that she had sat with his words. She had thought about them, but not to refute them, but to see what they might be saying between the lines. She found a way to respond to him from a place of listening. She didn't raise her defenses. In fact, she actually allowed herself to kind of be pried open, which was obviously very painful to her. And so we've been talking about what an act of prophecy does. And we've been talking about how it's sort of future oriented. It's about liberating. And it occurred to me that a lot of new potentials grew out of that moment. A lot of new futures grew out of that moment. There was a new future for the class because suddenly we knew that we were going to be listened to deeply. It was a new future for that professor's relationship with the student because he actually became kind of a constructive member of the class. And it was a new future for me too, because I started to watch her to see how you could listen the way she listened, because I was so impressed with what she did. And I learned to let difficult situations pry me open. I received more possible futures from what she did. And so I would say that that professor was being prophetic during that time. She wasn't always prophetic. I saw her in a lot of different situations. And so I would say that being prophetic, kind of to build on what you guys have been saying, is when somebody expands the potential futures of the people that they interact with because they listen deeply. They can pry open our futures because they're willing to be pried open themselves. So when we're in a prophetic situation, we come out saying, the world is bigger than I had expected it to be. And so is my heart. That's what happened to me. I don't know, you guys got anything?
I like the idea, though. You just reinforced the idea of listening. I mean, again, we should be paying attention to the traditions who listen to as many voices as possible, especially the voices on the fringe. And I've learned that at Sunstone, you know, when I came here, and it was just perfectly acceptable in Mormon studies for people to treat Sunstone like it was fringe, as if it was bad. And I'm like, what's your problem? Fringe is where it's at. That's where we should be learning from. And in all of my work with all of these different Mormon fundamentalist groups, I have to say that the communities that are the healthiest are the ones whose leaders are listening to and involving everyone in the community, especially those in the fringes. And when we see this sort of top-down hierarchical thing where people aren't paying attention to that, I think it's a really toxic culture. It makes people doubt their own ability to expand. Like you were talking about, Stephen, all of us, I believe every human has unique circumstances and situations and insight into something. They all have a story to tell. They all have wisdom to share if we're willing to listen to it. But the second piece that you talked about, something that is a personal value of mine, which is I never want to ask something of others that I'm not willing to ask myself. And that's a really hard practice. And it makes me vulnerable a lot, makes me weak and messy. But man, it's been so great to see in this COVID response, the leaders who are putting themselves on the front lines, who are taking their own pay cuts, who are willing, they're willing to do what they're asking others to do. They're willing to sacrifice, they're willing to work hard. And it's not just about being able to trust someone who's doing that. It's about being able to walk with them, because if someone's willing to open themselves up and do something that they're asking others to do, then it shows that they're giving an opportunity to commune with and to be part of, rather than to stand up apart from and sort of, you know, preach salvation or whatever.
That's really interesting. We're talking a lot more about silence than about preaching. Take it away, Misha.
I love that, Lindsay. And I think that that's such a good model when we're looking outward for prophetic counsel or for fruit from a prophetic tree, right? How do we know? We know by the fruit, right? And one of the things that's been powerful for me and a process and a practice that I hope to keep as a verb in my own life of is when I am able to have moments of prophecy for myself, when I am my own greatest prophet, when I trust myself and know myself and listen to myself, listen to my body, listen to my heart, listen to and my mind, and really tune in to be able to multiply my own potential and to continue to produce prophetic fruit. I think that I want prophets, because I don't know everything and I'm not going to be able to guide myself on everything. But for someone who grew up in the LDS tradition, to always look to the external, which is so contradictory to personal revelation and the doctrine of personal revelation, but still saying that you look outward, you look to a white man to tell you about yourself and about your potential and about what you need to do. And when I liberated myself to be able to find the prophet within me and say, in this moment, how am I going to prophesy for myself, step into my own power, and produce my own experience in this world, that has been a practice that has been so healthful for me in a multiplicity of ways. And it's something that I would encourage in others. So how do we see prophetic moments from others and in community, but also in ourselves?
It almost sounds like prophetic acts are most potent when they're either just for ourselves or perhaps in interaction with one other person or a very small group of people.
I think that's the case most of the time, just because it is so difficult to expand to a point where you can encompass more. That's where we get really rare people that are able to have that kind of foresight. That's where we get Nelson Mandelas. And those are few and far between. I believe that that potential is in us. But this is where I think the concept of a prophetic people rather than just a prophetic person has a lot of power. Because if you have a community, that is what Misha was saying, has that intrinsic listening ability to actually listen to what is happening inside, to what is guiding and calling you and teaching you and pushing you to step out of your comfort zone, to step into someone else's place to help, to teach, to learn, to understand. That, if it's a community that's doing that and working that together in that place of vulnerability to learn and then expand and help, that's huge. But that's so difficult, especially if we're looking at it within a Mormon context, because you're taught to not look in for that prophecy unless it aligns with what your leader has told you. And being able to step out and pull in from yourself and trust that and run with that, that's amazing. That's beautiful. And if you can get that community together to work, a prophetic people, I think, could very much be transformative for a time, a situation, and for any that it comes in contact with.
Stephen, can I say something to that a little bit that I've been noticing about a Mormon movement happening right now? sorry, I think I'm getting sick, so I'm kind of out of it today. But I've been following the Julie Rowe movement, which is an extant movement of Mormonism where people are claiming to have revelation. They're forming community about it. They're using traditional LDS tools to build a theology that's sort of outside of traditional Latter-day Saint, I don't know, constraints, I guess. What's been interesting to watch, we have a group of Mormon scholars and we just all watch the development of this theology. One of the things that I think also to add on to what Daniel said is if you're building that sort of theology, we shouldn't be afraid to get rid of some of the old tools. I see Mormon doctrine reappropriated over and over and over. It's just recycled for a new prophet, new theology, whatever. And I'm thinking, why are we using just those tools? There's some great tools within Mormonism. And again, shout out to Community of Christ. I've seen how they have taken those tools and relearned a purpose for them. So they're still using the tools, just not in the way that they traditionally were supposed to be. I think that that's really, really healthy for community, because if we're still just recycling the same tools, if we say, okay, well, a prophet looks like someone who's really good at reading scriptures, who's really good at predicting the future, that's what a prophet has to be, then that's what you're going to work within the framework if you feel sort of this calling to expand upon your own personal theology or community theology. And that's where I think it can get dangerous, because then you're only using the tools in a toolkit and not pulling from other places. And even Joseph Smith did that. We know that he was very eclectic in how he drew from his theology. And so why shouldn't we be able to do the same thing? I mean, like I said, Misha's work, Misha being my friend, has opened me up to a whole different theoretical framework to look at things. And then I have, you know, like Elisa Wall, she's someone who I consider to be a prophet. She escaped from Warren Jeff. She's the one that got him in prison. He's an FLDS prophet. she knows a lot about recovery and victim recovery and sexual trauma and all of these things. And to hear her speak, to hear her speak to her community and the way that she rallies around it, I just don't know why we wouldn't want to constantly be listening to the wisdom around us to get our own prophetic revelation. And so that's why I like this idea of prophetic people, because I think if you're listening to one tradition, one leader, one toolkit, you're going to be so limited. Because the reality is, President Nelson, for all that he knows, for all that he has experienced, he doesn't know what it's like to recover as a kidnapping victim from sexual trauma like Elisa Wall. She knows that. And so she can speak to those things. And, you know, President Nelson doesn't know what it's like to be a Black Mormon not allowed in the temple. But we have Black Mormons that can talk about that, and there are lessons to learn from that. And so, again, I think I'm just repeating the same thing. I just think that our tradition is richer, our theology is richer, if we're pulling from a lot of different sources, but especially those from the margins.
LDS General Conference just went by, but it's interesting to compare LDS General Conference with Community of Christ World Conference, because they get together and they, in fact, confer. You send delegates from your various congregations. They bring ideas and possible policies to vote on. And actually, one of my favorite articles that I ever published in the magazine was by Bill Russell, where it was called "A Faithful Disagreement: A Model for the Saints," and he talks about what the Community of Christ learned from when they voted to give women the priesthood, which resulted in a huge fallout. Like, pretty much everybody who was against giving women the priesthood left. And so then in 2013, they were voting on whether LGBTQ people should be able to hold the priesthood and run congregations, and whether they were going to consider gay marriage a sacrament. And it was really interesting to see how he portrayed everything happening, because the most important part of the entire process wasn't to convince people that this should happen. Even though a lot of the upper leadership of the Community of Christ did think that giving them the priesthood and honoring gay marriage as a sacrament was a good idea, what was most important to them is that everybody talk together and discuss it all. They use what are called listening circles, and the entire idea of it was to get together and be able to share your experience and your ideas unguardedly, and not be attacked for it. In fact, you couldn't respond to what a person said at all. The only thing that you could do is listen to them and present your particular ideas. And so they took years for congregations to simply sit and talk with each other about it. And the reason they did that was because they constantly said at every moment, the community is more important than anything happening. The bonds of love are the most important things. And if we listen to each other, and if we understand each other, then those bonds will stay strong. So then, when they did the conference where they were voting on these things, they put up a background that it was of aspen trees, because aspen trees are all rooted on the same root system, and they come up from that root system. So they're trying to remind everybody that they were all part of the same system, and that the community was the most important thing. And it was interesting to see how they did it, because they had very few people who were really polarized. Most people came together to talk about it as if it was something that they really needed to understand. And then when it did pass, and it passed by a huge majority, there wasn't cheering, there wasn't yeah or anything like that, because everybody was really concerned that the community remained together. And so instead of taking decisive political action to do what was right and things like that, the community and their connection was the most important part of what they were doing. And I think that's one of the things that really sets the Community of Christ off from a lot of Mormon traditions, is how important it is that you affirm that us being together, that's the most important thing. You feel that love? That's what we want to keep.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought them up again, Stephen, because the Community of Christ has been such a guide for me to show how I actually think they're leading the way in so many ways in the Mormon Restoration tradition, because we talk a lot about personal revelation. We talk a lot about eternal progression and modern prophets and this unfolding of revelation, but we don't really take it seriously unless it's just, you know, minor cosmetic changes or something. Community of Christ has radically uprooted some of their doctrines. Full inclusion for American LGBT members, priesthood for women, ordination worldwide, I believe. All of these things. Faithful disagreement is one of the most helpful things that I think that they've come up with. And I think that they've been able to come up with some of this brilliant theology, this brilliant way to conflict resolution, this really equitable sort of restorative justice ways, because they were willing to look at themselves and uproot the things that need the fruit that we're talking about, the rotten fruit, uproot the trees that didn't work anymore, the branches that were rotten. And I think that's really brave. I think that that's what's needed to move a tradition forward in a way that is prophetic.
And so the thing that I'm really interested in, taking everything that we've said into account, one of the things we said is that prophecy is about liberation. Prophecy is about abundance. Prophecy is about multiplying. Prophecy is about expansion and connection. Those seem to be the main words that we've been using. And so I'm interested in what the Brighamites, Salt Lake Mormonism, could do. I mean, there's a lot of us, and I think we have some tremendous potential. But what are there things that we need to break down first? Are there tools that we have that are especially good? Go for it, Misha.
Well, first, I mean, you have to get rid of the persecutory complex, right? The persecutory complex is going to hold you in a pattern of defensiveness, stagnation, it's a very kind of scarcity mindset, right? When you're always kind of like beating against you're engaged in some type of a battle and you feel the need to like win that battle, to like win your seat at the table and have a voice. Like we have money, we have a voice, we have a lot of power. Like those things, yeah, those are now our truths. So we have to really do a critical analysis and interrogate ourselves and our own positionality within within America, within the Christian world, and within the broader, the global community, to say, like, you know, even though, you know, a lot of people still don't know our names or who we are, or mix this up with the Amish, that happens a lot in New York City, that to recognize that we're not under attack. Right. And if we can put down those weapons of war and pick up tools to build and soil that grows beautiful produce and beautiful things, right, that things grow from our work, as opposed to our work is to battle, to prove our worthiness, that we're going to do amazing things. And our rainy day fund, hi, it's raining. It's raining. So you have to recognize when it's raining, when there's a situation, and your positionality, because there's so much that we could do with our resources, with our industrious kind of work ethic, with all the good things, with our tight-knit communities, with the ways in which we often can slow down to listen to that still small voice, whether it's within or from the outside, to really be a tool in this moment and in moments to come. I think we could have a great impact, but we got to check the ego, and we've got to see ourselves as not fighting against, but building with.
So another layer on that, or possibly just a slight reframing, is I think the intention would need to shift, because the Mormon communities are about service and they love to go out and help other people. But a lot of times the underlying intention is to promote the church, to help people feel connected so that they'll listen to the message, that there's always this, that missionary mindset underneath to get people to come and do with you rather than the pure intent of love, where you care about them for who they are and you wish to give to them without expecting this return from it, but you're actually wishing to impart unto those people. And that centering of love, that is one of the biggest things that actually like pulled me from the church in a lot of ways. When I was on that 10-day meditation retreat and the days after, when I was meditating on these things and thinking about them, when the guru was talking about love, discipleship, and what that pure love is about, what metta meditation is about, what actually caring about people in a holistic manner is about, I realized that that just wasn't happening in Mormonism. That wasn't happening in my experience in all of the family wards and also all the YSA wards that I was part of, that there was always ulterior motives to the love that was being given. Sometimes it wasn't like the person to person, but within the context of the community itself, it held it back from freely giving and caring about other people. And I think that if that could shift to where when people come and say, hey, I'm in desperate need, can you help me with the fund, like things from the bishop's storehouse, that the bishop doesn't say, well, you got to give back to us first. And then yes, I remember that on my mission, that there was a brand new member in Gyula in Hungary, and he needed help. He was a poor guy. And they kept saying, give us your tithing first, and then we'll give you stuff. And that was so hard, because where was the love? It was, I want to create a pattern for you. I don't want to just help. So I think that is one thing that would need to shift greatly, is to be able to actually center on love thy neighbor as thyself, rather than so that this can happen. Rather, it's truly just love your neighbor as yourself and give.
So I want to add to that too, to what both of you said, because this idea of love, as you were talking, Daniel, I was thinking, because you said you didn't find it in the Mormon tradition, and I agree with you, although I do think it exists in the Mormon tradition. And again, I've talked about it. I've seen it in the fringes. I've seen it in the margins. And I think the component that we miss often is, for you to love on such a radical level, you have to be afraid. You have to love and not be afraid of penalties. And Mormonism has unfortunately become a tradition where we like to ascribe penalties to things, you know, to, like I said, we've sort of become this top down, we'll ration your worthiness. And so what that does is it stops us from being able to fully embrace and love ourselves, even the parts of ourselves that maybe contradict or don't, you know, really fit congruently with Mormon teachings or commandments or something like that. For me, the most transformative, radical acts of love have been when people have loved me even when they're not supposed to, right? So when people love me, even though my ideas were different, even though I was following a different path, those are the most transformative acts. When you know that there is something at stake for people, they have to step outside of their belief system, their biases, their bigotry, their discrimination, and say, you know what, at the end of the day, this person, I'm going to choose to meet them where they're at and see them as a real human being, just like myself. But I think the reason why it's so absent from Mormonism is not that Mormons are cruel or uncaring people. It's, I think we forget how to love in Mormon theology when we become so obsessed with earning our way into heaven. I don't know that that's a really conducive environment to self-love and to radical love. And when Misha talks about abundance, the practice that I have to center myself in is out of self-love. When I'm talking about abundance, I'm sharing something, but what is it that I'm sharing? And if I believe there's nothing left for me, no worthiness left for me, no salvation left for me, no belonging or community left for me, then what do I have to share? I have to hoard it. I have to keep it, you know, food storage forever. But I think that if Mormons really want to embrace this practice of being a more prophetic people, we have to be willing to love even when we lose something for it. And I think that that's a really hard concept for people.
But at the same time, it seems like that is the actual definition of love, is loving even when there's a penalty. Otherwise, isn't that exactly what Jesus said? Even the tax collectors take good care of their kids. Yeah, he said something like that, right? Even the people you think are evil do the basic things that you think are good. But you have to love so that it's a sacrifice. And that's basically what Jesus was doing the entire time, right? As he was going through his ministry, he was never getting the accolades of his community. He was doing the things that his community said he should do in their doctrine, but it was against the culture of the time. He healed the centurion's son or boy or something like that, which didn't make him any friends. And he went and he ate with the tax collectors, and he went and hung out with the prostitutes and things like that. So at every point, he was actually sacrificing his cachet in his community. He wasn't doing things where he's saying, look, my community, I'm sacrificing. Aren't you proud of me? No, the things he did actually made him sacrifice his community's approval. Nobody was saying good job. Nobody. And so that's why sometimes when I see people like saying, look what I did, guys. Isn't it great? Don't you approve of me now? Don't I have the community's approval now? It doesn't seem to me like that's what Jesus was doing. He was saying, you have to sacrifice your community's approval in order to do something, and this is the other part, that's helping somebody who needs your help. But yeah, those are all really good things. So we've been talking about how to become a prophetic people, and the basic idea that I've gleaned from this is that a prophetic act is something that that comes from abundance. It liberates and it connects. It helps us see the world as a larger place than we thought it was, and also makes our hearts bigger than they thought than we thought they were. So it's about connection. And the interesting thing, Lindsay, is that if we go to church, we're on the parish model, so we're frequently around people that we don't agree with. And we have to interact with them. And so it seems like going to your ward is like the perfect way to do all this. The only problem is we have this liturgy that we go through every Sunday, every Sunday school, every Relief Society, every priesthood meeting. We don't sit and talk with each other as if it were a listening circle. We just give each other the story again. We say, we're all in on this story, right? We all agree on these rules, right? And so we just get together to do the rules. But it sounds to me like we're talking about, if we want to be a truly prophetic people, we have these people. We're especially good at being prophetic when we are being prophetic with the people that we're actually connected with. It takes an extraordinary person to be a big prophetic person, but we can be prophetic on an individual and small basis. That's where we're especially good at it. And that sounds like, you know, a Mormon Sunday school, especially if we have the little ones that I like so much. But when you get in there, you're in there to be prophetic. And by prophetic, it sounds like we mean you're there to connect with the people as they are and to have them connect with you too. And it's that community, it's that love that is first and foremost above making sure that the story gets told and the rules get told. And so the basic idea I'm getting is, if you want to be a prophetic people, you have to foster connection that liberates people to find their own inner prophet that will guide their lives, which will lead to further connection, which will make more room for people to be prophets and make further connection and bloom as people. Is that a fair summary? Is that what we've been getting at?
I think that was a good summation. Yeah.
And can I just add one more thing? As you were talking, I was thinking of the term progress. We often, in Mormonism, we're supposed to be expanding on our doctrine, eternal progression. Progression is in our theology, that word. And yet, their progress, because of American politics, probably the idea of conservative or progressive, the word progressive has gotten a bad word now. It's loaded with political meaning. But, I mean, why would we fight progress? Why would we fight moving something towards the future? And I think that if we can let our love expand towards that, to some sort of progressive act of compassion or love or healing in this world, why would we fight that? And so I think that, you know, when we're talking about this, we should be able to take all of our tools and look at them and hold them up in the light and say, are these useful? Am I using this hammer the way that it needs to be used? Or can I use it for something else? Because I think that that's one of the most prophetic things people can be doing in their own lives.
Any parting words from you, Misha?
I mean, I've loved this conversation, and I've loved, what both, you know, Lindsay and Daniel, and I really appreciate, Stephen, you, the way you've kind of tied it all together and given us something to maybe a reimagination of profit. And I think that again, that progress piece is really important, that it's movement and it's growth and it's expansive and it's abundant. And that so long as we are engaging in the verb profit or prophecy, I think we're on the right track. And we can do a lot with that.
What about you, Dan? Any parting words?
Yeah, I think the last thing that I would just tag on to this is, for what we are saying, what comes with it is a lot of discomfort. So there has to be the willingness to love through your comfort zone into discomfort, that you may expand and understand greater than you are at the moment. And that with that can come volatility and chaos, because you come to understand things differently than you have before. You come to see things differently. And that's where the shifting happens. That's where the change happens. But that's also where growth and expansion happen. And it's amazing. But you have to be willing to get to the other side of discomfort. And yeah, that'd be the last thing I'd say.
That sounds good. I really want to thank all three of you for being a part of this. This has been such a rich discussion. I appreciate it a lot. And just to return to earthly things, all this got together, but it wasn't totally free on our end. So even during times of pandemic, Sunstone needs your donations. So if you go to sunstone.org/donate, you can donate there, just like the URL says. We're also on Givelify. It's an app for donating to nonprofits. So if you've enjoyed this discussion, if you want to see more, help us out. Help us keep the lights on. We'll see you, folks.